Getting the smile and confidence you've been dreaming about, all from the comfort of your home, isn't a total mystery with Bite Clear Aligners. Just don't be surprised if all your friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. Bite Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Yo, this is Jamie St. James from the great Black and Blue. You're listening to Talking Metal. Crank it up.
Mark Striegel. John Astronomy. The Talking Metal Podcast. Coming to you from the Silver Spacecraft. I'm Bud Friendly. And now your hosts, Mark and John.
Hey guys, welcome to part two of three of the July 12th, 2011 edition of Talking Metal Live. Jamie St. James from Black and Blue joins us for an interview on this hour of the live show. And what else? Bud Friendly and Eric Bonenstiel in the studio with us, hanging out, two friends of John and myself. So, again, here we are, John Astronomy, Mark Striegel, Eric Bonenstiel, Bud Friendly, with part two of three of the July 2011 version of Talking Metal Live in podcast form. Right now, Black and Blue, Hold On to 18.
I'm
And we're back for another amazing segment of Talking Metal Live.
So let's talk some black and blue right now. Eric, our guest for today's Talking Metal Live, were you surprised to hear that Black and Blue was back together, actually doing a new album? I guess they had done some touring over the course of the past 10 years or so, but Jamie returned from or left Warrant for what reasons, I'm not sure, and reformed without Tommy Thayer, who was for the most part, I think, the songwriting partner in all those original Black and Blue albums. Reformed the band without him. Surprised, shocked, could care less.
I was excited that the excitement wore off when the album their new record was announced, coming soon 3 years ago, it was.
It took a while,
a long time. There was some public acknowledgement that we're back doing this record's coming out, we've got a title, we got something, and then just years went by. We changed presidents and a lot of things change. And then the album just kind of secretly came out. I know they're on Frontiers, that Italian label, I think.
Yeah, smaller label, yep.
Frontiers does a lot of stuff. I mean, they have, they have Journey and stuff, I think, too. I mean, they do big bands, but over in Europe. But their presence here is limited. I mean, I like a lot of bands on Frontiers.
Yeah.
I was psyched that they got a deal. But the record just kind of peeped out. Like, there was no mention of it really, I think, on a lot of sites and stuff. So maybe it's just a slow burn, and maybe some people.
It is
come
a pretty
to
good
it.
Record.
It is
I
a good
listened
record.
To it. There's some real good tracks on
Monkey.
Hail Hell.
Monkey.
Yeah.
Monkey's a great track. Yeah.
And a lot of great stuff on the record. So we're looking forward to talking with him. I remember, Black and Blue is kind of interesting because, I feel a lot of I like to call them second generation, commercial metal fans, if you will, don't know that band, people who were into Warrant and stuff, bands that came out in the later 80s, a lot of them don't know Black and Blue.
They were on the first Metal Massacre compilation with Slayer, and I think Armored Saint and a lot of other now forgotten
Metallica, there you go,
little bands that couldn't, Black and Blue was part of that, the early mid-80s bands, like second tierish bands like Keel and Kickaxe, and a lot of these bands that never really jumped over. Although Black and Blue had more records than all those bands, they did four or five consecutive records.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think
they even put out a box set like 10 years ago, a DVD, way back
there
when.
You go,
And
Hold On to 18 was obviously the big I don't know if it was a big, but it was one of those kind of videos that snuck on MTV pre Headbangers Ball, if you will. And I remember I didn't have MTV, but I would go over to my friend's house and just hit record on his Betamax and get 4 hours of MTV. And then I'd go home and fast forward through it looking for the gems.
See, I wouldn't fast forward. I lived in Germany, so I would have friends tape MTV at night for me and just mail me the tapes. And I would, because I wanted to see a Sprite commercial with Cool Modi in it and stuff, because we just didn't get all that. We didn't get that stuff in Germany, so I would watch it all front to back, and then all of a sudden, Black and Blue, Miss Mystery would pop up right after, some non-rock song. You know, when MTV just didn't have genre-based programming, it was just, here's a bunch of music videos. Enjoy, kids.
Yeah,
here's your babysitter for the next 3 hours.
Yep. And yeah. Black and Blue, interesting. A lot of big name producers they worked with, of course, Gene Simmons and Bruce. What was that guy's name? Bruce Fairbairn. Is that his name, John?
Fairbairn.
Yeah. 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 And yeah, what's the other guy? The German guy, Dieter Dierks. Yeah, Dieter Dierks did the first.
Febreze Music, because, yeah, he did the Twisted Sister stuff, Except,
and yeah, the Scorpions records, too. Yeah. Well, he did Blackout, maybe?
I'm not sure,
but yeah. So definitely some big name producers that Black and Blue worked with, and definitely a band that I always felt should have been a little more well known.
They didn't sound like anyone else. I mean, especially with Jamie's voice, like, they were a singular sounding band. No one sounded like them. You know, their take on melody and everything. I mean, they were, you know, sort of the Pacific Northwest version of kind of a harder docking to me. I mean, they just sounded like themselves. And it was a shame that they didn't get more traction, especially over in Europe. I mean, they were an obscurity in Europe from my perspective. But yeah.
Cool. Cool. Yeah, it's interesting, the whole Metal Massacre thing. I was actually researching it, and it's funny. The first pressing, Black and Blue, wasn't on, apparently. And
really?
I can't remember who was... They replaced somebody on the second pressing. It may have been
what
Rad,
was the
Rad or
was the song? Was it Strong Will Rock, or what was the song on that on Metal Massacre?
Chains Around Heaven?
Yeah, that's what it was.
I think so. And so it should be interesting to talk to Jamie. The new record, I think, sounds really good. I'm excited about it, and he will be calling in hopefully about 5 minutes or so. So let's stay tuned for that. We'll get into a little music, I guess. How about some Black and Blue? Maybe one of the classics right now, and we will check out some new Black and Blue a bit later. Let me see what I have as far as the classic stuff goes here. I got Sight for Sore Eyes off of In Heat. I got Rockin' on Heaven's Door, Auto Blast, Hold On to 18. Mr. Astronomy, any requests out of those few?
How about Auto Blast?
Yeah, that would be mine. That would be mine, too. Yeah.
Cool. Here we go. Blast.
Hey, guys, Jamie, are you on the line? Jamie, hey, it's John Astronomy. Are you on the line?
I'm here. How you doing?
Hey, great, man. It's really awesome to have you on the show. I've been a fan of Black and Blue for many years, dating back to the early 80s, and then, of course, being a Kiss fan. You know, I was really into the Nasty Nasty record back in 86, and, you know, it's great to finally have you on Talking Metal, so thanks a lot, man.
Good to be here, my friend.
Hey, Jamie, Mark Striegel here. We also have Eric, so there might be three of us shooting some questions at you, but again, thank you so much for calling in. We're very excited about the new Black and Blue record. We were just talking about it, Hell Yeah, which is out now. What made 2011 the year for Black and Blue to return with a new album?
Oh, man, we actually started, I got a record deal in, I don't remember, it was about 2003 or something like that, I can't remember exactly, and it was a solo deal, and I decided, you know what would be much more cooler is to do a Black and Blue record, you know, who cares about a solo Jamie St. James record, so I basically called the guys and put it together, but it just took us forever to get the whole thing recorded. We changed labels midstream. Jeff Loop Warner, who had a recording studio, he lost the studio midstream. I joined Warrant for 4 years. You throw all that together, and then the fact that half of us live in L.A., the other guys live in Portland, yeah, it was just hard to get together. But 2011, it finally came together, and bam, we're here.
Cool. And you have, I guess, he's not all that new to the Black and Blue fold, but as far as the recorded Black and Blue, he is. Sean, where did you guys get him?
Well, he's from Portland. Patrick and Whoop still live in Portland, Oregon, and I was up there, you know, working on the record, and it was recorded all in Portland, Oregon, actually. And so they said, "Look, we got a guy. He can do the part. You know, let's check him out." And basically, I just got to know him, and those guys swore by his playing abilities. So we gave him a shot, and he's worked out really well. He's been in the band 8 years now, or something like that.
Great. Now, you guys did a reunion with Tommy a few years back, right? Back in Portland?
Yeah, we played with Tommy here and there. We got inducted into the Oregon Music Hall of Fame, and that was just like about a year ago. And Tommy played with us then. We played a set, and we got our award and all that stuff. The whole night was geared up for us, and it was pretty cool.
Yeah, congratulations.
Go ahead.
I said congratulations on that. That's awesome.
Thanks. Yeah, it was a lot cooler than I thought it was going to be, you know. We didn't get a lot of love in Portland when we were playing clubs and stuff. I mean, we were playing clubs and we were playing Hold On to 18, but no one liked, you know, original music. They all wanted cover tunes, you know.
Right.
And they just were like, we got to get out of here. But you know, it was really nice to go back and get that, and it was really a great night for us, and we had a sold out crowd at a big theater, and it was this, you know, standing O when we got our award, and it was pretty cool. But yeah, we played with Tommy a few times. We did a benefit for a friend of ours who had cancer. You know, every now and then Gene will let him off the leash and he gets to play with us.
Cool. And so obviously your relationship with Tommy is still quite good. And has he heard the new Black and Blue record? I'm sure he probably has, right?
I just talked to him about 4 days ago, and he's in Canada with Kiss right now. And he told me, he goes, "By the way, I ordered the record off Amazon." He goes, "I got it."
That's great.
He goes, it's really, really good. He goes, "You guys should be really proud of yourselves because it's awesome."
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. It's a great, great record. One of my favorite songs, Hail, Hail. Any stories behind that one?
You know, that was a lot of that was penned by Jeff Loop Warner, and he just, you know, he played it for me, and I thought, this is killer. He played me his demo, so we went in and worked it out, and, you know, I kind of added a couple of St. James touches in there, but it's, you know, it really is a great song. It's a, you know, it wouldn't be a Black and Blue album without some kind of an anthem on there, so there you go.
And now you mentioned Gene Simmons earlier, and you actually have quite a history with Gene yourself and the Kiss guys. You wrote a song on the Carnival of Souls album.
Yeah.
Any thoughts on that record? It's one of those records which you either love it or hate it. It was kind of an odd record for Kiss. Any thoughts on that album?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it is an odd record for them. And it's funny because Gene and I did a demo at his house for that song. And I went down to the studio, and when they were recording the record, And he goes, oh, yeah, you want to hear it? Sure, let's go in my car. And he plays me the song. I go, it sounds just like the demo. And he goes, yeah, that's what we were going for.
Right.
So I just thought, wow, okay, well, whatever, you know. I mean, it's a really weird, raw Kiss record. It's odd. But, hey, you know, I mean, Gene asked me to help him out, so I did it.
That's great. Now, being a Kiss fan, how did you and Tommy first hook up with Gene to even have him come and produce Black and Blue?
We, in 1985, we went on tour with Kiss. When Without Love came out, it was for Kiss, it was the Asylum tour.
Right.
And they took us on the road with them. So, I mean, that year we played Madison Square Garden. That was pretty cool, you know. Yeah, we toured with Kiss and got to know him. And it was, you know, that was the first time I had ever met him. And at the end of the tour, we were getting ready to probably start writing and do another record. And I basically asked Gene if he wanted to produce us, and he said I'd be a fool not to. So
that's
we
great
went in with him, you know.
And you know, it was a great time period because that was right when Gene was getting into producing, and it was just a great mix, Black and Blue and Gene. And then I also wanted to ask you, how did it come about that Jonathan Cain came in to do I'll Be There For You, which was a great song and video? And of course, Talking Metal listeners, Jonathan Cain was from Journey, The Babies, Bad English.
Yeah, well, that was set up by Geffen. That wasn't even going to be on the record. We did that for a movie soundtrack.
Okay.
And so we went in totally separate with Jonathan Cain. He produced it. We did we went into the studio just to record that song for a movie. And when Geffen heard it, they said, no, it's not going in the movie. It's going on the record.
On the record,
so, they said, that's the single. So,
right.
Okay, well, you know, we didn't have any choice about it. I didn't think it fit the record really well as a whole, you know, in a balance. It's a great song. But, yeah, it was kind of it just didn't seem to flow with the rest of Nasty Nasty. But, you know, it's what it was.
Great tune. And then, of course, Gene was with you again during the recording of In Heat.
Yeah. Yeah, one of the things that we wanted with Gene was we wanted a little more control. We were trying to not let the record company tell us what to do so much, which they always did, which sometimes was great and other times not so great, you know. We would never get a choice on certain things like picking our singles and stuff. So we thought if we had Gene, we would have more power because he would be more on our side than the label side. So
right.
That was kind of the thought. But by the time we did In Heat, there are some killer, killer songs on In Heat. There's some great stuff, but we were a little bit panicky, you know, because it was like Geffen told us no video. We're going to give you some tour support, but you know, we just thought, oh, this is not good. So, and then Gene tried to actually buy us off of Geffen.
Wow.
He offered them a huge amount of money. He says, I want them on Simmons Records.
Wow.
I want this to be on my label. And they go, no, we're not going to, well, we will not sell them because we'll make our money back on them. And if they pop, we got them. If they don't, they're done.
Wow.
So it was a pretty weird position to be in.
And besides Gene Simmons, you also worked with some really other big name producers. Could you talk a little bit about who else Black and Blue recorded with?
Yeah, our first record was done with Dieter Dierks, who, if people don't know it, he did all the Scorpion stuff, all the early stuff. All the killer stuff, you know. And we picked him. We actually went into the studio with somebody else here in Los Angeles, and it was just sounding like not good. What they had done before was Jackson Browne and that was their, and Don Henley. That was their thing. They didn't understand what we wanted to do. So we ended up picking Dieter Dierks and we got him. Our second record was huge, getting Bruce Fairbairn and Bob Rock together.
Wow.
to produce that and engineer that record. That was our choice, and Geffen made it happen. And it was obviously a really great choice because they went on to do many, many, many great things after us. So.
And how was it working with Bruce? I know I've heard even like Paul Stanley wasn't real happy, I think, when Kiss worked with him.
You know what? He was a nice guy and he was a great guy. I will say that without Bob Rock, I don't think it would have worked. But with Bob Rock and him, it was fine. You know, Bruce was more of a kind of a managing guy, you know. He has a musical sense, you know. He's been in bands, you know. But I think without Bob Rock, it wouldn't have been the same thing. You know, Bob brought a lot to the table. So that's why it worked. If you don't have Bob Rock with Bruce Fairbairn, you didn't have the right combo.
Interesting.
Now, how did you guys hook up with Frontiers Records?
We were on Z Records, and they had given us money, and it had long been spent. We needed money to do to finish the record. Z Records was kind of more doing live shows. We didn't think that they were really going to get behind the record like we thought they would in the beginning. So I just told my manager, "You got to get us another label. You got to get us a new label, and we need more money because otherwise, we're not going to be able to finish this record." So he did it. I mean, we sent some songs to Frontiers, and they jumped on us. So, and they bought us off Z Records and gave us more money to finish it, and they saved the day for sure.
Very cool.
Hey, Jamie, this is Eric. I just I had a question. How you doing, man? I had a question for you just about your web presence, actually, and finding out what's going on with Black and Blue. And I don't know if you were listening before you called in, but we were kind of chatting about you guys and. I know the record was announced like a few years back. You know, there was an announcement, Hell Yeah is coming. And then you just explained why, what took so long and everything. And it finally had to gel in the right way. But yeah, what's going on with Black and Blue going forward from, like, let's say right now? What's going on for the next, rest of the year, touring? Or are you guys staying in the States, going to Europe, more Canada, or any touring?
You know what? There's nothing set up right now. We wanted to play anywhere we could in America this summer. We're trying to get, but we're a little bit late in the game. By the time the record came out, our booking agent was kind of fighting to get us stuff. We did the M3 festival, a while back, and that was very cool. And we were trying to get onto some more festivals, but I think we're a little late in the game. So, we're doing this Monsters of Rock cruise in February with Cinderella and Tesla and Kicks and a ton of bands. But we're like basically looking for those kind of gigs. As far as Europe goes, we'd love to do it, but there's no plans right now. And you see, the thing about it is we just we're told our booking agent that get us some fly-ins, get us to the East Coast, get us to Texas, get us to some places where we're doing well. And just do a fly-in here and there. But we're not going to get in a van and play crappy clubs and go out there kill ourselves. We're just not into that anymore. But we're trying, man. We're trying to get out there. It's a tough economy, so let's see if we can do it.
Absolutely.
And, Jamie, I wanted to ask you, were obviously in Warrant for quite some time. What happened with that whole situation, and why didn't you continue with them?
I was in that band for 4 years, and it was basically just a touring situation at first, and then we decided to do a record, and we did that. And, it was basically a gig to go out and tour and play. And basically one day they sat me down and said, "Look, Janie Lane's good. We're going to have him back. We got some good offers. If he can be in, if he's back in the band, we're going to have a good thing going." I said, "Okay." I figured, I mean, that's the way it should be, so that's cool. And so I went to go forward with the Black and Blue stuff. I thought, okay, now this gives me time to let's get this record finished and let's, get Black and Blue out to play some gigs. And I guess, as it turns out, it didn't last that long. I don't know how many shows he ended up doing, but it wasn't what they expected, and it just kind of fell apart. And so then they called up Robert Mason and got him. So I was fine with it because I just wanted to do Black and Blue. So, it's all cool. They're trying to do what they can without their original singer, and that's tough.
Right.
It's tough.
Now, Jamie, professionally you're known as a lead singer, but you actually started out on drums. And tell us about your childhood and who were your influences and all that. And then I know that you were a big Peter Criss fan.
I started out learning how to play guitar, and I kept that up well enough to be able to write songs. So I write a lot of the tunes. I write a lot for Black and Blue. That was the first thing I ever did. And then I wanted to get a drum kit, so I did. By the time I was 14, I was playing drums. And so I just played drums and kept on, practicing guitar just to get chords and figure stuff out. But I did not become a lead singer until 1981 when we formed Black and Blue. I was a drummer all the way up until then. And I was, I sang a lot of backgrounds and, I would sing some. I thought it was dumb to be a singing drummer, so I didn't really want to do that too much. I just did a lot of the backgrounds, what I knew I could sing. But anyway, there was no other guy in Portland, Oregon that could be a lead singer. So I just said, I'm gonna do it, and I'm gonna get Pete Holmes to play drums because I know he can kick ass. So basically, that's how it was out of necessity because there was nobody in Portland that I trusted to front my band. But when I left the band that me and Tommy were in, we purposely left it to form Black and Blue. So
now, what age did you leave Cleveland?
I was only in Cleveland for about 3 years.
Oh, okay.
Cleveland, I lived in Cleveland from like 99 to 2002 or something like that.
Oh,
that
okay.
Short run. I was born in Portland, Oregon, grew up in Portland, Oregon, lived in L.A. most of my life, and I went to Cleveland for just a few years as an experiment, but it was cool.
Cool.
And we're kind of heavy metal history buffs here on Talking Metal, and I wanted to ask you about being part of what a lot of people point to as such an important album in heavy metal history. That's the Metal Massacre, the first Metal Massacre. You guys were on that, but only the second pressing, is that correct?
Yeah, we weren't on the original. Somebody pulled out. I don't remember which band it was, but somebody decided they didn't want to be on it. And so Brian Slagle called us up and said, listen, you guys were my other choice to be on this thing, because we sent him our demo. It was the first demo we ever made. And so we said, okay, sure. So we got on it, you know, the second time around. And I don't remember who it was that bailed out, but kind of glad they did, because it gave us a little notoriety all of a sudden out of nowhere. So, yeah, that was kind of cool.
It was interesting. Just on a side note, I was reading that the Metallica then re-recorded their song that was on that record for that second pressing, because they didn't like the way the original one sounded. So, interesting.
You know, I think ours didn't sound all that great either. I mean, but that was back in the days when we were young, didn't have any money, had nothing, you know, just were trying to get any kind of a demo we could get together. So, but, you know, it was a little part of metal history, at least for that at that time period, for sure.
Yeah, definitely. Well, we'd love to feature some of your new music off the Hell Yeah record right now. What would you like to play for the Talking Metal listeners?
Let's play Target.
Great. Thanks so much, Jamie. And where's the best place the Talking Metal listeners can get in touch with you online?
Facebook. We got Black and Blue on Facebook and Jamie St. James on Facebook. Probably Black and Blue is good because I'm topped off with 5,000 people. But go find me on Facebook, Black and Blue.
Excellent.
Great. Jamie, thanks so much, man, for coming on Talking Metal. And as a longtime fan, I really appreciate it. And we hope to hook up with you guys in person when you're in the New York area.
Well, cool. Thank you very much, guys. I really appreciate the help. Thank you.
And cool. This is Target by Black and Blue.
Ain't no Mr. Rogers, but I still like Eskimo Bite.
That was Electric Love by Keel, also produced by the one and only Gene Simmons.
Yeah, the
Kiss.
The Right to Rock. What a great, another one of those bands like Black and Blue, right. You know, who never quite cracked the top, if you will, in my humble opinion. And that's no disrespect towards Ron Keel, who's been on the podcast, and Jamie, who we just spoke with. A big Talking Metal toast. I am drinking
Talking Metal toast.
Red Stag. I've never had this before.
Let's do a Talking Metal toast. Cheers. With everybody else here. We got a special guest, Nejan, here hanging out with us.
John's friend has dropped by the studio. Full house. We got Jody working the board. Guys, thanks so much for joining us on Talking Metal. We're listener supported, and I'd like to thank you guys. There's been a few donations to PayPal.
Excellent.
I owe you some money, John.
Oh, hey, no problem.
We've sold a few, not much, don't get too excited. We've sold a few t-shirts, which is also nice. Thank you for your support. Use the links in today's show notes to open up your iTunes, and that'll take you over to Black and Blue, and you can download the song Target that you just heard, and you can buy a bunch of other music while you're on iTunes. We get a kickback on everything you buy, so like 3 to 5%. There's also Amazon links on Talking Metal. I know a lot of you guys shop on Amazon, so before you go to Amazon, just go to talkingmetal.com and use those links to open up your Amazon. You can send me cash, which I will split with John in the mail. No one has sent cash yet, but we are awaiting the cash to arrive.
Cash donation
at Mark Striegel, P.O. Box 404, Maplewood, New Jersey, 07040. Again, just put TM on the envelope, and I will split it with John.
If you don't put it, Mark will keep it.
Yeah.
I'm kidding, guys. No, I'm just joking. Mark, I have to tell you, Mark, you've been doing such an amazing job with Talking Metal, with the website, with everything. And guys, listeners, please still have faith in me. I've been working very hard on the book, No Regrets, with Ace Frehley, and I've been out on the road with Ace, and so I've been in about 10, 15 different cities in the last month, and it's really an awesome experience to do that. But I do want to thank Mark for keeping Talking Metal alive.
Well, you're keeping it alive, too, and I appreciate you changing the site so I can,
Mark can update
it with my limited mental capacity. PayPal, I did, after about working a day on it, I was able to add the PayPal widget to our site.
Very, very cool. Yeah, no, it's great.
Thanks to Chiaki, who pointed out that wasn't working as he donated $5 to
the cause.
So thanks to Chiaki for the not only the donation, but pointing out that our PayPal button did not work.
Hey, you know what, Mark? I wanted to tell you, speaking of me being out with Ace, that I was lucky enough to meet a bunch of great Talking Metal fans and listeners from both the TV show, the podcast, the radio show, everything out in the road in different cities. So you guys are keeping Talking Metal alive, and we are grateful eternally, and we thank you for doing
it. Is this officially part of the O-Files, or should we begin
the O-Files?
Mishaps of John Astronomy.
No. I think we're going to save those for the final 30 or 15 minutes of the show.
A little teaser to keep the listeners going.
Stay tuned. What we want to do now is talk to our good friend Eric, expert, because he has to leave around 9 p.m.
Yes, he does. What do you got going on at 9 p.m., Eric?
Well, after a 14-hour drive from Caribou,
Caribou,
Maine.
Possibly just sleeping.
Population Caribou. And then driving to D.C. and then back to New York last night. So,
jeez.
Yeah, I don't know where I am. And
What took you to Caribou, Maine and to D.C.?
July 4th.
Oh, cool.
July 4th. Yep. Decided to go somewhere where it was 48 degrees at night. And boy, we got it. Yeah. And there were more signs warning of moose than people.
Wow.
So, yeah.
I've never seen a moose in real life.
You know,
they're kind of a bizarre biological like crapshoot because it looks like a camel and a horse. And somehow, strangely enough, a German Shepherd all had a really fun night. And supposedly they're like the rhinos of the north. They're dangerous. If they
will attack you.
If you see them, you're supposed to like find a tree because the only thing they can't do is climb trees. But that's coming. They'll figure that out, I'm sure.
Little aside.
Yeah.
My childhood nickname, and it still lasts to this day among my family in Pennsylvania, is Moose.
Moose.
So, very good.
Mine's Bones. Always has been.
Bones is still. Yeah.
So, guys, there's a weird situation happening right now on alternative rock radio. This is a band. I don't know if you guys have heard of this band, My Morning Jacket.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And they have a hit single right now called Holding On to Black Metal. And it's about, I guess it's about black metal. They're like,
I haven't heard it yet.
Yeah, let's do it. We won't.
Sound sample.
Yeah, a little sound sample, Jody, if you can work the boards for us.
Keep the mics up.
This is My Morning Jacket with Holding On to Black Metal. Kind of definitely not a black metal song, if you will, but.
Sounds like
let me
James
fast
Bond
forward,
or something. Yeah. Not Jamie St. James, but the old TV show, The Saint. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, they sing about it's like the lyrics are about Lucifer and stuff, and then it gets to the chorus.
But it's really not.
Yeah, let's get the chorus. Hold on.
Put it back up.
Here you go. So there you go. That's what all the cool kids are listening to right now.
Yeah, I don't know. Are they qualified to sing about black metal?
Yeah, I don't know if they're making fun of it. And they were talking about Lucifer and stuff. I thought black metal was more about the whole Viking era and anti-Christian and other anti all religions from what I understand.
From my understanding, that band, though, they have tendril roots in metal. I mean, they really do.
So those guys are kind of like metal guys who are now really
play
cool
other stuff.
And they're playing this weird stuff.
Yeah, and I think they're, not that this matters, but they're a state I would not have predicted them from, not a lot of bands come out of, is Kentucky.
Wow.
There you go.
Yeah.
I will go on record saying that I actually like this song. So
it sounds like a James Bond intro. Like you expect to see credits.
Yeah. You know what when I mentioned, I don't know if you guys heard me, but it was like under the music, I had mentioned a show called The Saint. And do you know that show?
Yeah. Roger Moore.
Yeah. Exactly.
That's the James Bond. Yeah.
Know that. But so I got that vibe too. So maybe it's a cool song.
Yeah, I like it. I don't know. I suppose most Talking Metal listeners.
It chews into our talking about Udo, but sure.
Yes, Udo.
Not that I don't know. I think we might have beaten the Udo horse
you know, as much as we can. But
what other songs have you heard recently that you like, Eric, while we have you in the studio? And is there anything we could play?
Two bands that I think should be in the retardo land of my mind touring at least Greenland together is Night Ranger and Decapitated.
Ooh, that's a both bizarre combination.
Both new records are fantastic. The new Decapitated, the band coming off an extremely tragic accident where the drummer was decapitated. So there's some dark ironic.
That's fucking crazy. Yes. So the drummer of Decapitated was decapitated.
As far as I understand it, yeah. And but man, they've got the new band back together. It's their first album in 5 years, and they're kind of in that Meshuggah math metal, really extreme metal stuff. But from a playing perspective, it's fun to kind of parse and figure out what they're up to. But good stuff. And then for just pure fun summer coming off 4th of July convertible rock, Night Ranger keeps going. They're on the kind of on the state fair circuit and playing Mohegan Sun's kind of, you know, gigs.
That
But their new record, Mr. Brad Gillis, as Ozzy always referred to him as, Mr. Brad Gillis brings it once again, and it's a heavier record than they've done in the past few years. And it's just...
And who's in Night Ranger at this point? It's, no Jeff Watson. Jack Blades is there.
Oh, yeah, Jack Blades is there. Kelly Keegi is still there. Brad. And there's the new guitar player, but he's been in for a while.
I think he's been in for a while. And I don't know. I always called him the surgeon. Remember the surgeon, the keyboardist who wore the surgical mask?
Oh, yeah,
mask?
He's still in the band.
Is he still in the band?
I'm pretty sure he's still in the band.
From the Muppet Show?
No, not from... But he was an important
surgeon.
Member of Night Ranger because
he sang
a lot of tunes along with... I mean, like, they had multiple people singing in that song. So.
He was, like, the only guy in the 80s, I think, who was in a video kind of consistently every few months who had a full kind of...
Beard.
Yeah. He had a beard. He looked like an algebra teacher, but with... You know, Mr. Brad Gillis.
Right. Yeah. There you go.
I interviewed Brad and
Brad, of course, known for the whammy, and Watson, known for the eight finger.
Yeah, the eight finger technique. Right.
And obviously, Mr. Brad Gillis for the always seminal "Speak of the Devil" album.
Yes. Right. Definitely.
You know that red guitar he had? It was like a red strat shaped guitar. It was probably a Fernandez. I actually played that particular guitar a long time ago in an early Night Ranger show after he was in Ozzy. But
I played the physical guitar, the real guitar.
Then I snuck backstage in my hometown of Johnstown, Pennsylvania, and I went up to the guitar roadie. And
okay, everyone at home, excuse me. That's the Johnstown, Pennsylvania moment of the night.
Yeah. Yes. it's true.
Always
so
at least
I played
one,
Brad Gillis's guitar back in the day at the War Memorial Arena, and I'm not sure what year that was, but it was, you know, Sister Christian time, wherever that was. What year was that?
It was 84.
1938.
Yeah. 1938.
Yeah, well, you had, I remember, Don't Tell Me You Love Me. Was
You Can Still Rock in America. All those big
guys. Which was the first record. And then...
Dawn Patrol.
Yeah, I remember my
friend...
That's
the record, yeah.
Derek Sivers, the first time I ever jammed with him, he came over, and Derek went on to found CD Baby many years later, but he came over to my friend Scott Lane, Lonnie Lane's basement, and we could barely play. I mean, we were just struggling to get through Paranoid, and he came... Plugged in he brought his Marshall half stack over, and we were playing like little tiny, like crate amps. And he plugged in, he played You Can Still Rock in America.
Wow.
Just solo, you know, as we stood there.
Like, amazed.
Yeah, amazed.
Now, is Lonnie Lane, that wasn't SS Priest, was it?
No. That was SS Priest was a guy named Sean Freehill who
went to my high school.
And who I recently Googled him just because I figured that guy should have been a rock star. Sean,
right.
He was in a band called Toys
and the Malls.
And he was just such a great musician, and it looked like he engineered a few albums. I can't remember, Four Non-Blondes or something. I don't know. But he never really became the rock star that everybody had him pegged to be in high school.
Now, who was the blonde guy that also was called SS Priest? That was a different guy.
Yeah, well, the story I've read, and I actually had exchanged letters, this is pre-email days, with Sean Freehill, who I never really knew in high school, but we exchanged a couple letters. Actually, I think I sent him about four letters and he sent me one, but he said that he basically, because SS Priest, whoever his real name was tied to Diamond Rex,
right,
that when DeMalls got signed. I'm going to have to go to.
But you're right. I forgot about Diamond Rex.
Yeah.
But.
Anyways, SS Priest was in DeMaul's, Sean Freehill as SS Priest. And then
the other guy got kicked out or left
after recording that first record. And they put the other guy, the other SS Priests.
In DeMaul's.
Yeah, in DeMaul's. Yeah, it's kind of confusing. There were two SS Priests.
Yeah.
One of them who was a guy I went to school with. So, yeah.
Hey. I got
their IMDb pages are very confusing.
Hey, now, this is a question for Eric Bones of Steel. Do you remember two different things? There was once a Nikki Sixx controversy where there were apparently two different Nikki Sixxes, there was a controversy that Tom Jones was in Black Sabbath. Do you remember that?
The Nikki Sixx one faintly sounds familiar, yeah. But you're talking about What's New Pussycat Tom Jones was.
Yes. There
in
was
Judas
Kerrang,
Priest?
No, in Sabbath. And
oh, Sabbath.
I swear to God that Kerrang did like a two-page thing that Tom Jones was now in Black Sabbath. And they had drawings of the stage and everything, but then it was like some kind of a hoax.
You know what I would say to that? I would say, don't let the details get in the way of a good story.
Right.
Yes, Tom Jones officially was in Black Sabbath for 9 years. Let's just say that. Right. And yeah. Yeah.
Now the funny
stage name,
yeah.
Tony Martin.
Right.
Yeah, now, exactly.
The weird thing, though, and I swear to God, I think I used to have the Kerrang where there were detailed diagrams. Now, maybe Kerrang was just playing a joke on people, but when I got the Kerrang magazine, I didn't get the joke, and I was like, oh, my God, this is nuts. But the crazy Nikki Sixx one is that there was this guy who literally went out and got all the tattoos that Nikki Sixx had at that point, and then he claimed that... he was in Motley Crue early on, but then he had to go to jail for some incident, and then they got the current Nikki Sixx in the band.
The replacement Nikki
Sixx. Yeah, so this guy... So
but yeah, that was, it was just a takeoff of the Paul is Dead thing,
right,
you know,
right.
but yeah.
Well, there was another...
He's in a band called Six Pack.
Yeah.
There was a Guns N' Roses thing that happened like that about 10
Mike
years
Portnoy
ago.
Too.
Well, do you remember Steven Adler had an impersonator running around Manhattan, checking into hotel rooms, going to bars,
wow.
running up tabs, and
sounds familiar.
As... him and you know crashed on people's floors and but it was all over like a it was like a 50 hour lost weekend. I mean he just tore through Manhattan running up bar bills, staying places free, crashing, doing drugs, partying with people, and people finally figured out
this isn't the right
this
guy
is not
right?
him yeah.
Well, Mike Portnoy the same thing actually.
Is that
there was
something
there was a fake Mike Portnoy going around and
jeez.
Wow.
It's really weird. It's so odd for the... Oh, you know what? There are
free
people,
time.
There are people that... There's a couple of fake Gene Simmonses that are going around, and they kind of look... There's one or two different guys, and they look a lot like Gene, and they don't really go up to people and say they're Gene, but they kind of pretend they're Gene. And because, like, the average person off the street might have seen Family Jewels, but they aren't... big Kiss fans, so they see a guy that kind of looks like him and they think that it's him. And what's crazy, if I were Gene, I'd be upset that there are people trying to get perks in restaurants and different things by dressing up like Gene, you know, black fingernails, you know, that Gene style haircut, and you know, like giving Gene a bad name in my opinion.
Actually, I walk around town partying and sleeping on floors and running up big bar tabs, and everyone thinks I'm Bud Friendly. And at the end of the night, what I do is I tell them I'm not.
I like that. I like that.
I am can
That's
be my own imposter.
Now, but
haven't paid a bar tab.
Are you,
haven't paid any child support.
Do you wear the mask?
Of it's not a mask. It's
a skin condition. Okay, that's
skin
right.
condition.
Right.
Very good.
Sorry.
Let's check out the new... This is new Decapitated, right, Eric?
No. Are we going to do the Decapitated? Do you want to do
What do you want to do? We got Night Ranger or Decapitated or possibly both.
It is truly up to you. I'd say let's go with Mr. Brad Gillis.
Okay.
First.
Yeah, let's
warm up to the Decapitated.
Right. We can't just get right into that.
Okay, cool. Let's start with a little Night Ranger right now on Talking Metal. New Night Ranger. We'll be right back.
And we're back. Don't call the cops. It's just us, Talking Metal Live.
Night Ranger here on Talking Metal. What Eric, what was that song called?
Lay It On Me.
Lay It On Me. I actually ran to the bathroom during this song, so I didn't actually hear it. I hope it was good. It was good, yeah.
Yeah, it was a great tune. Those guys are really great guys. I first met Kelly at Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp when I was working, which I still am, with Gibson Guitars. So he's a cool guy, and I was really psyched to meet Jack and Brad as well when I did the interview.
The Talking Metal chat on the Talking Metal forums is going, and we have Chief Beck checking in saying, Sister Christian ruined this band. True to that statement?
Yeah. I think it was a 20-year hangover is what it did. But I think the song actually is power ballad nonsense ended up taking off after that song. I think it got its vindication in Boogie Nights when the guy is lighting off firecrackers in the cocaine house. Like that song just took on a whole new fun meeting with Alfred Molina running around with his houseboy, and that song just cranked so loud that the speakers are buzzing. Yeah, it's a fun song now in that context.
When I was jamming with my friend Ranger X Terry Camori, and Lonnie Scott Lane, the same basement that Derek Sivers came down and wow, dazzled us with his fast finger work on the fretboard. Lonnie Lane's dad used to come down and test the PA, which he bought for us to practice
man,
with.
And great.
He'd go, Sister Christian! He'd come down
and
he'd sing that song in the
great
PA. Good memories.
Yeah, very good.
That is an equivalent to Johnstown, Pennsylvania memory, but yes, somewhere west, I imagine.
Yeah,
of that.
No one knows what I'm talking about.
That
but anyways,
was in Hinsdale, correct?
Yeah, oh, the great
You know,
Hinsdale,
every person to this day that says they're from Chicago, I go, hey, I've some friends from Hinsdale. Like every single person, like you cannot get me to not say that when somebody mentions Chicago.
Hinsdale was an interesting town because I swear to God, I went to the Hinsdale Central High School, and in the 80s when metal was just booming, there was like no one who liked metal at Hinsdale Central.
Wow.
It was a very preppy. There was like the smoking section crowd. Get this, guys. Get this, kiddies.
What
back in the 80s, kids could legally smoke at school.
It's freaking crazy. Section. That is insane.
Yeah, all you had to do was get your
mom
to sign a little ditto. They call them. You guys don't probably know what dittos are. Dittos.
The mimeograph.
Yeah. Yeah,
ditto paper.
You just take it home and say, I give, you know,
Morse code,
Grace, whoever, Park,
mimeograph,
you know, permission to smoke at school.
At school. Yeah,
and of course, the kids, you just sign that themselves,
right,
you know, and then you'd come back. And,
if you got an actual signature from a parent on that, your parents
well,
were hoodlums.
The 80s
hoodlums
was
too.
Different. Yeah, the 80s was different, you know.
That is the funniest thing I've ever heard.
So there were a few metalheads in the Hinsdale Central smoking.
But now, who were hanging in the smoking section? What did they
but
listen
I never,
to?
I wasn't, right. I was a nerd. I like, you know, I was in jazz band and dug metal. So not only did the jocks hate me, but
the
smoking section
guys,
people didn't get me either because I didn't smoke, you know. So it was a lonely existence there at Hinsdale Central. But anyways,
name two metal bands hilarious from Chicago.
Two metal
two
bands?
Of the biggest metal. If you can just give me a couple of metal bands from Chicago.
Metal bands. Well, you had Trouble from Chicago, right?
Trouble. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. How about E-Trope?
E-Trope.
That's getting a little scary. Yeah.
I mean, not metal, but commercial pop metal. Enough's enough, obviously.
Right.
Enough,
sure.
Enough,
yeah.
Yeah. But the bands we used to go see in the clubs were bands like Paradox, Hammer-On, Diamond Rex.
Right.
Rex. There you go. Yeah.
Trying to think of. There was another band that I used to go see. Damien Thorne was a band that I used to go see in the clubs. Yeah, in Chicago.
Did you ever watch the show The Chicago Code?
No.
It's a show on either Fox or ABC, and the theme song is sung by Billy Corgan. Not written, but sung. Good show. Cop show.
Cool. So, let's see. Chief Beck checked back in. Didn't Ozzy say that he encouraged Brad Gillis to leave and pursue Night Ranger? I think he said that on Talking Metal.
He probably did.
It's very possible he said that.
You know what's funny is that
Ozzy also said on Talking Metal that Brad Gillis replaced Jake E. Lee.
No, I was like, my favorite thing that Ozzy said, and I have to go on record and saying that both times we interviewed Ozzy, he was so cool and so together, and you know, nothing like that you would think he would be on, as if you only watched the Osbournes. But the one thing I thought it was funny is like, what's that guy's name? And it was Brad Gillis. He's like, who's that guy that was a guitar player in the band?
Yeah, I'm sure, I mean, I'm sure chronology is sometimes
a bit blurry. He looked at John, he's like, what's that guy? He was in Night Ranger. What was his name? I swear to God,
What's the guy from Night Ranger? And what was so funny is we told him, I think we asked him, like, how was it playing with Jake E. Lee? And he was kind of blind, and he might have been blind. And he was like, I didn't know that. Like,
no, he said that's not true, but it's apparently online.
Yeah, I'm not saying that Jake E. Lee is blind, but I think he did have a vision, legally blind, right? Which I feel so sorry about, but
yeah, I don't know.
It happens if you masturbate too much, I understand. That's what they always used to tell me.
I mean, Jake E. Lee is one of these interesting guys, much like a Vinnie Vincent.
A mysterious guy.
Mysterious, yeah. So big, you know, in the metal crowd, hard rock crowd, if you will, and just virtually disappeared off the planet. I mean, we've seen some little clips of Jake E. Lee.
He was jamming in Las Vegas or something, like a cover band.
Las Vegas, yeah, or I don't even know.
Yeah, I always wonder about these guys like Vinnie Vincent or
well, did you hear about
like, how does he buy Diet Coke? Like, does he work at Kinko's? I mean, he doesn't, royalty checks aren't just pouring in. He has a job somehow. I mean, I didn't get into it with Jamie from Black and Blue, but clearly Black and Blue is, you know, an itinerant sort of project. I mean, they don't have, like he said, we're not booked through the end of the year.
Right.
So he's got some other life that he does.
Yeah.
And Black and Blue is something they check in, you know, he's actively pursuing, but still, like, it's not a 24-hour day job.
Right.
But it's like a Vinnie Vincent guy who's clearly been out of the mix for 20 years or more.
Did you hear what happened recently?
Well, oh, yeah, yeah. The follow-up,
let's talk about this.
Yeah.
We have not yet had metal.
You haven't talked about this yet?
No,
well, I talked about it on one of the solo
episodes.
But,
yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So let's bring it up once more since we've got the round table group here. Vinnie Vincent, guy who nobody knew what was going on with the guy for many, many years, is back in the news because he had a domestic dispute. And then what was even weirder is that when the police came, they found multiple dead dogs in plastic bins, which were apparently discovered to be temporary graves.
Yeah. So what he issued a statement hinting at that this horrible press and situation has somehow brought him closer together with loved ones that he's been removed from, which I took to be possibly his twin daughters.
I think he had with
a wife. Vinny had a previous wife who was murdered.
Right. Because she was a secretary or an assistant by day and some kind of weird call girl / prostitute. Same thing. By night.
Yeah.
Keep it classy, Connecticut.
And somebody
in
Connecticut.
Two jobs.
An ex-con. Yeah, an ex-con killed her. And her twin daughters were wondering why their mom didn't pick them up from school. And here she was killed by this guy. And that was a complete tragedy. And then Vinny, of course, it comes out now that he's married. But what the weirdest thing about Vinny Vincent, and I am a huge Vinny Vincent fan, is that the rumors were that Vinnie Vincent was on the verge of becoming a woman. And what was weird is the only photo of Vinnie released in the last, other than his mugshot, maybe the last 10 years, was him holding up a poster of himself that was signed when they were doing the Kiss World store in Australia. And you couldn't see his entire body. And then you saw some kind of shoes that looked possibly like they could have been like slippers or something. And so it kind of kept it going because it was.
It
like,
looked like he bought those shoes at the Limited.
Yeah, right. Exactly. So it was a weird thing.
In the female department. I don't even know if there's a male department in the Limited. I'm assuming there's not.
Right. Ace was asked about this even once, and he said, hey, man, I don't know, but, you know, if whoever wants to do whatever they want to do, go for it. Who cares? Like, you know, he wasn't saying anything negative about that. But it was just weird that the rumor was so strong that it would, you know, journalists were talking about it. So
right. Well, we traced that back through our investigative work.
Yes, right. You've talked to the guy. Right?
Yeah. There was a Kiss convention that he was at somewhere, Atlanta or somewhere, and afterwards they took Vinny out to dinner. I think you guys have all heard me tell this story.
Tell again.
And at the dinner, these nerdy, if they're listening, which I know they're not, I'm sorry, but you guys are nerds. These nerdy Kiss fans had Vinny there who had thrown the convention, and they said, so what are you up to next? And he said, my wife and I are going to get a sex change. Oops, somebody's cell phone going off. I think that's where that rumor
started. Yeah,
now, I have a sneaking suspicion that he was pulling their leg.
Right, I think so too.
And it went over these guys' heads. They didn't really get it because let's face it, the guy wears mascara and buys his shoes in the women's department at the Limited. Right. So it's like, you know, they brought, oh my gosh, you know.
Yeah, and then it kind of spiraled out of control. And then here's what is so crazy, though, is that Vinny has successfully been able to live this life where no one knew where he was and what was going on. And then this happens. And then there's this news piece from Nashville where you see, and this is what I think was hilarious. You see like the reporter standing there and you see like, reminds me when I was like, you know, living in the outskirts of some rural town. There's like these like, you know, 10-year-old kids riding their bikes behind like the newscaster right in front of Vinny's house. So now everyone knows exactly where Vinny Vincent lives.
Yeah.
Well, and no one's gonna really apply that knowledge in any constructive way.
Other than crazy Kiss fans, though, because Kiss fans will go down.
I think
there.
It's much more like the hunt is better than the catch. If he puts out a new record, you just plan on possibly being the lowered expectations rule should really rule here. But I have some other kind of crazy news about him that's from earlier in the year, pre dead dog domestic violence pre-D. In January at the NAMM convention out in Anaheim.
Oh, the guitar.
Yeah, I had a friend at the Vinnie Vincent booth.
Right. Was he working there or he just went there?
He was not there. And my buddy Ethan, I'll say, was texting me constantly and sending me photos, met his wife and said that...
okay, so that was Vinnie's wife.
Vinnie's wife
booth.
Was the only person there that he was talking to. And my buddy Ethan is a longtime fan like us, fascinated by the kook ball that is Vinnie Vincent. So he's talking to her. And he didn't have any kind words visually to say about her, but said she was just completely strange and squirrely. And he was asking questions, not trying to pry too much, but, you know, what's up? You know, you got this guitar. What's Vinny doing? Well, he's working on this and that. And, you know, she was trying to be the face of this kind of amorphous, nebulous company, but it's not a company.
Right.
It's like- he's basically got this guy who's a... Like, I don't know. You might know more about this guy who's building this guitar.
Yeah, no, I know nothing
about him. But they rented a booth at NAMM. That's not cheap to do.
Right.
They had, you know, they had latex signage made up.
Right.
Yeah, oh yeah. They had a full thing. And he said no one was there.
Yeah.
Like, he spent, you know, a half an hour there. No one there.
Right.
It was very creepy. Jeez. They were over in the corner. Like, no.
And these guitars were going for a lot of money.
What's that?
I said the guitars, apparently the prices on them was like outrageous, like, you know, heavy duty.
How many
like,
people, and you're an expert, let's face it, you know everything about Kiss that there is to know.
Thanks.
How many people, realistically, guesstimation, would buy this Vinnie Vincent signature model? You don't have to be
signature
kind
model. I'm
this
talking
new
about
guitar
the,
that he's putting out. No, this new guitar, whatever
the
they want to call it, that he's putting
I'd
out.
I'd say... 25.
And how much is he charging for it?
I think it's like $3,000, right?
Something like, at least $2,000 to $4,000 or $5,000.
So maybe he can pay for that booth at NAMM.
Maybe 25 is
he
like
delusional? Does he think he's way more famous than he is?
No, I mean, I think worldwide. I mean, he could put out something online on iTunes and make a couple of bones.
You know,
I'm
adjusting the number to 100. 100.
Okay, 100.
Okay. I heard inside every guitar is a dead dog.
Yeah. No. Well, here's the story on the dead dog.
Maybe 100. I don't know. Like, I'm basing this on, you know, how many people have a lot of money to buy one of these guitars? Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe 300. I don't know.
Yeah.
By the way, if you haven't seen the guitar, it's not timely. It's
singular
thing.
I
mean,
personally, I would buy the guitar if I had $3,000 extra.
Yeah, I mean, it's a Vinnie Vincent guitar. So if you haven't seen it, do imagine what you will. But it looks like all the cocaine decisions that went into the visual aspect of the band in the 80s.
Yeah.
Now. So
yeah. I would buy the guitar, but I spent all my money on women's slippers.
There you go. Right. Limited.
You know what it is that nowadays, the Kiss fans, you know, your average Kiss fan who was a Vinnie fan might not have $4,000 on the average to spend on a guitar. And then you add the fact that it's a, you know, kind of an 80s shape, like a double Jackson V looking thing, which I love personally, but, you know, it's just not a guitar like your kid who's going to go into Sam Ash is going to go buy.
Financially ranking Kiss fans.
Right.
Individual fans of which members of Kiss have the most money in order.
Wait, tell me again.
Which individual fans, members of KISS, individual fans of those members.
Oh, you mean like which Gene Simmons fans are the most wealthy?
Well, I think Paul Stanley fans might be the most wealthy because they are buying the Paul Stanley artwork that costs like 10 grand for one of these paintings.
There you go.
He's making a couple million dollars. So, I mean,
are you serious? He's making a couple million off his artwork?
He makes about $2 million a year off the artwork.
Yeah, I've heard.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Yeah, he.
Like, I swear to God, like when the statistic came out, it said, "Oh, Paul made $2 million on his paintings in X year." So
okay, well, listen, I want to get into some music, but let's just wrap things up on the dead dogs, Vinnie Vincent's dead dogs. He has something like 30 rescue dogs. So his rebuttal to that was it was rescuing all these dogs, and one of them was extremely vicious and killed a couple of the other ones.
Right, and those dogs.
Yeah. You know, anybody who has a bunch of rescue dogs at their house, that screams mental insanity.
Yeah, there's like 1,000 dogs.
Yeah, it screams
house, right?
Male mental insanity.
Yeah.
We know he hasn't gone through the sex change.
No,
otherwise, he would have a house full of cats.
Yes, there you go. Good point.
Speaking of news people, just a side that only Mark probably will get. You remember that guy that used to say, if a certain guy is coming to your house, hide. That guy that used to like go after sexual predators on NBC.
Oh, Chris Hansen.
Did you hear he got in trouble now?
Yeah.
He having an affair. But,
got zapped for cheating or something?
Right. But I mean, he wasn't having like an inappropriate relationship with a kid, but he did get zapped. So it was just hilarious because Mark used to always say, if Chris Hansen is calling, like, don't pick up.
Right.
They always have brownies.
I don't remember
they
saying
always
that.
Mike's Hard Lemonade. Like
they always have brownies and lemonade on the
table. No, it's always the Mike's Hard Lemonade. And I always laugh. It's like the boys in marketing over at Mike's Hard Lemonade, like, God, this is
awful.
Damn
it, we got the pedophile recipe. And then so Chris Hansen comes and goes, what are you doing here?
Yeah. You can leave if you want. I'm not doing it.
Cool, guys. We're going to get into a little music right now. Big thanks to Eric. Are you hanging or are you taking off?
No, I'm crashing. I gotta head uptown and go to sleep. So, okay. But it's been great to be here, guys.
Cool.
He has to go somewhere, Eric, and pretend to be Steven Adler and then go to sleep.
I'm going to run up. Yeah, exactly.
Cool. Well, we're going to be coming back with Andy from Black Veil Brides.
I can't wait for this interview.
We are definitely excited for it. I can already tell that there are a lot of fans of Black Veil Brides listening to the stream. So, guys, thanks for joining us on Talking Metal, talkingmetal.com. We're going to get into a little music right now and be back with Andy real soon. This is a band, actually, I think Eric may have introduced me to. I'm not sure. Sister Sin with Death Will Greet Us. Did you introduce me to them?
Yeah,
I think so. And we'll follow that up with a little Children of Bodom. This is Death Will Greet Us, Sister of Sin on Talking Metal.